Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose-Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of health, food, and the environment, policy and science, popular attitudes, and the media. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your individual well-being and the well-being of our communities, of our society, and of the earth. I have been for a long time a health reporter, and then about a decade ago, I began covering all of the things that go on in our society that really impact health. So while we're out seeking personal health, we see the poisoning of our water, food, air, and earth. We see the takeover and degeneration of our government, and we live under the threat of basically extinction due to climate change. And yet our individualistic focus makes it very hard to act appropriately and kind of catch up with what's going on, and that's what we discuss each week on this show. Today I'm really excited. This is going to be our New Year's show, the first, show we're doing in 2018, which is the beginning of the eighth year of Connect the Dots on Progressive Radio. And so we got, I think a very timely topic. We're kind of, as usual, taking the bull by the horns here. I'll be speaking today, and I'm honored and happy to have as my guest Shane Burley. He is a writer and filmmaker based in Portland, Oregon, and the author of a new book, wait for it, Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It. This is published by the AK Press. Shane also contributes to a host of publications, some of which I also contribute to. His writing can be seen in Jacobin, Alternet, In These Times, Political Research Associates, Waging Nonviolence, Labor Notes, Think Progress, and several more. And you can follow him on Twitter at Shane_Burley. B-U-R-L-E-Y, one. And, people are always, when I am critical of the mainstream media, which is always and often, I'm frequently asked, what else would you suggest? And, I routinely suggest Alternet, Jacobin, Counterpunch, Common Dreams, and Truth Out, Truth Dig, and host of other publications, and I think what I've just given you is a kind of broader list. So please take heed and follow some of those sites, too, for accurate news. So here we are. It is not quite a year since the inauguration of Donald Trump. A lot of people, Shane, have been saying things like, oh, thank God, 2017 is over. What a terrible year. And it's just kind of ironic. It's like the idea is like somehow if you turn the page, everything, we get a new start and everything is going to, get better again. And, that's kind of not really such a likely immediate prospect unless we figure out very clearly what is going on and how to effectively engage with it. And so that's why your book, Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It, is incredibly timely, I believe, in bringing people up to speed and setting them on the right track rather than just kind of going, I resist, which, sounds good, but unless it's really a lot better thought through and strategized and structured, mere refusal or resistance or saying no or you're not my president or whatever, on its own won't be enough. So welcome to Connect the Dots, Shane Burley. I'm delighted to have you here, and we'll be diving right into this.
Great. I'm glad you have it on.
So first off, I think we can't begin without going, asking the question for anyone who's unclear about it and is kind of like, oh, we're maybe not quite at fascism, and, how many more hours do we have? What is fascism? How do you define it?
Yeah, I use a kind of a couple points to really draw out what we kind of say is the essential nature of it. And so There's a couple really key things. One is this idea of human inequality. That's really at the core of it. inside of a fascist movement, a really ideologically consistent fascist movement, there's a belief that human beings simply aren't equal. That's a really that's the underlying issue. That's mixed with what we call kind of an essentialized identity. This idea that we have an identity that we don't choose, that essentially chose us. Usually race, it can be gender, it can be other things too. And so that's kind of what you find in the ideological hardcore. That's the alt-right, that's neo-Nazis, that's white nationalists. And so that's anytime that there's an actual fascist movement, there's a real core to it that's pushing the radical agenda as much as possible. Now, that's really fundamentally different than Trump, right? Like, that's a lot different than right populism. It's right. It's a lot different than what we see in a fascist mass movement, which requires a larger coalition of people. And so I think when we think about something like Trump, or we think about the broader movement in the U.S., our fear is that it moves beyond simply the minority movement, which is definitely dangerous and violent, but it doesn't have state power, to the stage where it becomes a major influencer of politics. And I think Trump himself, while maybe he doesn't meet the litmus test all the time perfectly, it becomes kind of a conduit for the actual hardcore white nationalist movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In other words, he. Can you talk a little bit about that movement? Because in your work, in your long time organizing, you've had direct encounters with it, which you detail in the book. And a lot of people, you know, for many people, this is just simply a kind of a you know, something they read in the news is happening somewhere else or some strange people. I mean, I'm speaking, you know, someone living in New York City. This is not something, you know, we do have our right wing and conservatives, but, you know, maybe the kind of thing that happened in this past year in Charlottesville is not really directly going on in every single community. Can you orient our listeners to, you know, what you're talking about and how far-reaching it is, where it tends to concentrate, you know, like that. Mm-hmm.
Right. I think it's just a clarification in terms. When we say white nationalists, we mean a revolutionary fascist movement, one that hits all those boxes, one that vies not just for state power, but to kind of reform society entirely, really based on the idea of creating monolithic ethnic states, you know, a state for white people only. And that would put them directly at odds with people of color, with queer people. It's not simply, it's a, you know, a heteronormative vision as well, one with men dominating over women and so on. And so, like, I think it's important to think about the fact that they're not simply peaceful conservatives kind of looking for their own piece of the world. They often want to portray it like that. That's not the case. It is a revolutionary movement. But when we say, like, where is it at? So even if you're in New York City, it's definitely there. There's the largest Proud Boy organization. There's neo-Nazi and Klan organizations, not just in New York State, but in New York City. There is not any city that doesn't have this. There is no part of the country that someone can think that they're free of that. Oh, absolutely. I live out here in Portland, Oregon, and people love to kind of portray Portland as this progressive center, you know, green politics, queer-friendly, things like that, but Portland is also a really heavy home of organized white supremacy. And this goes back decades, but we think even just back maybe 20, 30 years in the 80s, a lot of countercultural, subcultural, and working class areas were completely dominated by neo-Nazi organizations. This is at the high rise of groups kind of called the Hammerskin Nation and other skinhead gang organizations. We're talking hundreds and hundreds of people in a city that wasn't very big. And coming in great conflict with a lot of community members, attacking people of color, attacking interracial couples, things like that. That never went away. That didn't disappear. A lot of those groups change. They reform. The people get older. They go out into the community, and new generations come in. But it is absolutely everywhere. One of the things was that historically there's an image of white nationalism in the U.S. of being this, I guess, kind of poor blue-collar movement. And there definitely is a tradition of that. We comes out of the Klan, which was largely a working-class constituency for years and years. But what we see today is that there's really large middle and upper-middle-class contingents as well. And that's really what the alt-right's made up of. These are, like, affluent college kids. And it's happening in suburban areas, you know, sort of the Midwest and definitely up east. And so there's all the kind of traditional markings of where you look for this or what people think are usually wrong. And in fact, in liberal areas of the country, it's oftentimes way more dense. So it's something that people should think when they see something on like Charlottesville, it's not just happening over there or in places we can't do anything about. It's happening here, wherever you are, and it's definitely growing.
What are the factors that are feeding this, that, you know, people are turning to this and that it's increasing? You know, what is, you know, what are the causes? I mean, you know, what are the factors that are making this grow at this time?
Yeah, I think there's the conventional answer, which I still think holds true to a degree, that the economy creates these kind of upsurges of white anger. There's a definite instability in the country economically. We're seeing, you know, the death of the unions, the death of stable workplaces, definitely the death of the industrial core. So we're not seeing jobs. We're not seeing like a very strong future that was really propped up by labor and other movements years ago. We're seeing kind of an attack on social welfare systems, attack on healthcare. All of that creates a sense of instability in the white working class. But it's not just that. And it would be really remiss for us to think of it as just that. You take that and you mix it with the fact that we really never dealt with underlying racial tensions very well. And that as we see demographics change in the U.S., there's a certain kind of what they call like the white lash, which is an anger about not feeling as though the country represents them because it has different types of folks than them. That creates a window in which a narrative can be provided that's revolutionary, that says like, yeah, we agree your life isn't going very well. Yeah, we want to see things different. Mm-hmm. We could do that if we, you know, do X, Y, and Z, target these groups and that kind of thing. And that's really running. Mm-hmm. It runs counter to a left narrative on what we think would actually be a useful way to deal with crisis in the economy and the state. And so what they do is they use the same kind of window opportunity that the left does to build their own kind of narrative.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it just comes to my mind, how does the, you know, the kind of, how did or how does the emphasis on identity politics in the 2016 campaign, you know, kind of feed into that, detract from that? You know, it's like every time, like I always feel concerned having covered and watched that campaign closely, that every time that we are, you know, on the progressive end of the spectrum or the liberal end of the spectrum are speaking to the choir, you know, by putting forth you know, the rights and justice and equality arguments for all of, you know, the non-white male patriarchal groups. We put those forth and we are, you know, we're all agreed about that scenario and, you know, like the importance of supplying all of that. And in fact, having attended the Democratic National Convention, you know, all of the presentations were about, you know, we're going to include and give a bootstrap to this group, to that group, to this group, to that constituency. It's, you know, it's all identity politics. You know, how does the narrative of that on the left, where we, you know, kind of feel like we are speaking to our concerns, feed into and exacerbate the growth of this dangerous movement?
I think it's a good question. It's one when they create a sort of parody of the left. If we just step back for a second, these far-right movements always create a parody of the left. They try and use left-wing language, they try and use left-wing social issues, and kind of flip them on their head. And so they use that kind of dialogue as an opportunity for their own messaging. So we fast forward to this idea of identity politics. Identity politics, in a lot of ways, is a pejorative that's used to talk about identity-based movements on the left. And even for those on the left, it's a way of kind of criticizing when people, you know, put certain kinds of politics without a good frame of reference, you know, talking about racial issues without talking about class, for example, or talking about gender without talking about sexual orientation, without kind of linking those things up, and they become kind of a form of advocacy. And what the right wants to do is to say, no, this isn't actually a movement towards greater freedom and equality. It's actually a movement for Black identity, or it's a movement for female identity or something along those lines. And so what they try and do is say, like, no, what's happening is group advocacy, not just
a complex way of going after existing oppression. And when it's not about existing oppression and actual conditions, it becomes an issue of groups advocating for one another against one another. And that's really what happened here, is the rise of white identity politics, which, even if you want to criticize left identity politics, it certainly doesn't come from the same place, and it certainly doesn't operate the same way. And so instead, more accurately, kind of white resentment politics. And what we don't want on the left is to actually fall into the narrative that they've provided of actually being about identity advocacy. Instead, we want to go after those underlying issues that people can link up to.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. That completely makes sense. So in effect, the way that we kind of talk about it can be adopted and misused, and creates almost like a distorting funhouse mirror effect. When refracted out to those who, resent, distrust, hate, whatever, all of the problems they may have, that perspective. Whereas what you're saying is, if we talk about it in an economic terms, we might be on better ground, but then again, they might find a way to do the same thing with that. So
yeah, I wouldn't say just economic terms. I think keeping it to broader political issues is useful, and not just issues of individualized advocacy, which is, I think, in a lot of ways is how the left criticizes identity politics anyway. It's not generally a term that's used with a lot of positive reverence. So I think it's about really kind of thinking through political positions and thinking about how to advocate those in a way that doesn't just reduce things to identity advocacy, but thinks about how they're going to affect people intersectionally.
Yeah, that makes sense. How strong is this movement in terms of numbers and leverage, would you say?
Yeah, I think it depends on which part of the movement we're talking about. If we're talking about the alt-right, the openly fascist white nationalist movement, it's not dramatically large, but it is much larger than we've seen before. So it's really hard to find kind of a numeric comparative in any of the last few decades. It really is not until back in the 60s in the third era KKK, or in the 20s, the second era KKK, do you see anything of size. So when we're trying to figure out the numbers, we don't really have accurate numbers because we don't have membership lists and we don't have an array of public events. We have a few metrics to go by. When we see that there's tens of thousands, it's debatable how much power they have. They have the power to shift public discourse. They have the power to hurt people in physical space. They have the power to attack people, things like that. That's what the white nationalists always had. The question is, do they have political power on top of that? And that's really debatable. They have the ability to influence political discourse, which then has the effect that can affect politics down the line. But they don't necessarily have open alt-right people in office, at least right now. I think it's fair to say that they are still an insurgent movement. They're still a minority movement. They're still small. But that doesn't mean that they're not powerful in a lot of ways. Revolutionary movements rarely have representatives inside the state. They rarely have representatives in mainstream media outlets. And so they still have the ability to cultivate a revolutionary counterculture that can do a lot of damage. And that's where I think the fear is with the alt-right right now. The larger Trump movement is different, and that's more like the vessel that they use to help mainstream their message, but that's not necessarily one of their core. And that in and of itself isn't as large as the rest of the GOP. I would say that it's very influential in its small numbers still.
So what is the danger in terms of, what do we, who obviously don't want this kind of fascism to take over our country, what are our most constructive things that we could do, to kind of help society?
Yeah, I think the primary thing is that people need to organize on a large scale, and they need to do it in public, on-the-ground ways. there's a lot of when Trump first was elected, and there was this kind of internet phenomenon with hashtag the resistance, but there's lots of organizations using that. It was rarely used in a way that could be functionally called any kind of resistance. And it was in a lot of ways an effort to kind of sate people, to give them the feeling that they're participating in refusing the Trump agenda or things like that. But the language of that without action is kind of futile at this point. People need to be involved in organizations and doing organizing on the ground that's going to affect that. And that can actually play out in a myriad of ways.
And so we can look at the growth over 2017, 2016, and 2017 of anti-fascist organizations happening in really mass numbers. That's a really great sign, and people should be getting involved in organizations that they have access to. There's a lot of organizations and projects that affect kind of more minute examples, not maybe minute's not the right word, but more specific examples. So organizations that are involved in labor that do this work, organizations that are involved on a regional community basis, maybe neighborhood groups, things like that. All of that's incredibly important. And people need to kind of disassociate themselves from the everyday rhetoric of it and instead find ways of contributing in ongoing ways to these projects, because that's really what's going to be necessary. If people are putting their eyes just to things like the next election, they're really going to miss 95% of what's really important. On-the-ground movements is what's going to stop these people. On-the-ground movements is what always has stopped these people.
And what do you mean? Tell people what you mean by on-the-ground movement, because honestly, I think a lot of people don't even know what we're talking about when we say something. You know, they're like, maybe Elizabeth Warren will be elected and we will be saved, or Russiagate will, you know, hallelujah, kind of turn out to, you know, impeach the president, and then we'll be well and like that, you know.
Right. Let's take that piece by piece. There is no evidence that a Russiagate scandal will impeach the president. None. Zero evidence that that's going to take place. I think that that hope has been happening for 365 days now, and it's going nowhere. So people really need to, I think, back away from these singular hopes that something is going to take down the president. And even if he does, there's an entire cabinet there waiting, and they're not going anywhere necessarily. There's no evidence that that's going to disappear. And in a lot of ways, to say that is to say that before Trump, we were in a stellar political situation, and we simply weren't. There's no evidence right now that the Democrats are going to be able to take things back and substantially change anything. And so I think putting that hope on there misses the people power that's actually required for changing the situation broadly, which doesn't just happen in electoral situations. It really happens in the way that we confront those issues all the time. And so the other piece of that is that the actual white nationalist movement, which is dangerous in terms of actual violence and the ability of putting out an agenda on the world stage by influence, what they call metapolitics, basically the culture before the politics, that happens whether or not Trump's there. Trump has no material effect on that necessarily. And so we could focus all our attention on, you know, midterm elections and then trying to get Trump out of there or something like that later on, and it will do absolutely nothing to the alt-right and the growth of the alt-right. And actually giving them that window of time by not counter-organizing them is only going to embolden them. That's what will get them the bigger numbers. And so I think in a lot of ways they would love for the left to focus on elections and not on them, and so that they can do regional recruiting and things like that. So I think the alternative to that is to find a community grassroots project that are going to confront the growth of the alt-right on the one hand, but then also go after the issues that kind of fuel the alt-right on the other. So there's a lot of really great examples of this. Some of these are new community projects. Some of these are old NGOs. Let's take an example. So if people live in rural areas, that also can feel like a tough place to do organizing. There's not a lot of people. There's definitely not like a left there. But, you know, a lot of organizations have done it. So out here in Oregon, the Rural Organizing Project, that's like out in eastern southern Oregon, they've done a lot of great work counting the militia movement. They've been doing regional organizing in a lot of counties that only have, you know, a few hundred people in clumped areas.
setting up regional organizations mm-hmm. there, and then doing counter-organizing, counter-recruitment for the militia, then also at the same time going after the issues that the militia recruits around. So in a lot of those areas, you don't have high-speed internet, you don't have really good access to public services, especially like ambulances, things like that. So the militia movement, basically the patriot right-wing movement, comes in and says, well, you know, we'll help you with those things. We'll help you get, you know, to emergency services. We'll, you know, do security patrols if that's what you need, whatever it is. And so in a lot of ways, when you come in with a rural organizing project and you help build community and you give resources there, that counters the need for the militia, and it at the same time allows you the opportunity to directly counter-organize the militia at the same time too. So that's a really great example, and those are the kinds of things that you can get involved in. If any person that's in a city, though, is going to have dozens of examples of this kind of work. Some of the more militant anti-fascist groups, the Antifa groups that people heard a lot about, a lot of those groups have existed for years and years and do really incredible work in terms of research about who's in the community and what they're doing, and then also get solutions for how to protect people from them. There's a lot of organizations that are trying to link up labor. Out here we have the Pacific Northwest Anti-Fascist Workers Collective that's linking up trade unions. There's a lot of the IWW General Defense Committee is using the structure of the old Radical Labor Union, the IWW, to kind of create community projects that can go after those. And the Twin Cities here in Portland, in New York, and a lot of other places. So there's a lot of organizations that are doing this work that people can be a part of. And I think that being a part of an organization that has a long-term vision, that's going to have goals and things like that, is a lot better than being atomized on your own.
Mm-hmm. So actually what you're saying is that people should, I mean, and you know, when you say on the ground, I think it's really interesting. I think people imagine themselves out at a march. Like, you know, I know people who, you know, went to the Women's March near, you know, going on almost a year ago. And, you know, hey, I went to the Women's March and, you know, kind of thing. And of course, it's fine. It's good that people go out and march and participate in protests. Nothing against that at all. But what you're talking about at when, you know, you say on the ground is actually, you know, it's actually participating, you know, finding an organization that matches your views and, you know, participating in that organization and building that organization on some kind of consistent basis. And actually, I think that's a really superb suggestion. Because also in doing that, there isn't, when you say atomized, you know, that comes about because we think, well, what can I alone do? You know, I alone can go on a march, or I alone can write my congressman, you know, but I alone, you know, it's really kind of far-fetched to sort of think that I alone could solve this whole problem. And so that's why we're looking outside of ourselves to, you know, hey, work a gate and, you know, let somebody solve the problem for us. But what you're articulating as the alternative, which I think is kind of more, perhaps more self-evident to younger people at this time, who have more, you know, the younger generations have more of a collective sense, I think, of themselves and their you know, their generation and everything. You know, we kind of sink or swim together and we're here supporting each other, is to you know, join an organization where you're building that organization as a group, you're connecting with people in that organization to kind of, it's a feedback system, you know, it's not just that you get an email saying time to write your congressman, but it's like, you know, you have direct involvement with people who are working together on a particular behalf. You know, in New York, the Fractivist, you know, organizing and grassroots community around opposing fracking in the state was just exactly that. There was, you know, actually a handful of different organizations that people could participate in. And then, you know, those organizations organized major actions, marches, letter writing campaigns, you know, various initiatives and stuff. And it just wasn't, you know, I think that's really kind of a brilliant idea. Is there any kind of clearinghouse where people who, you know, I think everybody knows, for example, on the environmental front, people know 350.org, people know, you know, all kinds of different organizations maybe on those fronts, or, you know, on the food front, Organic Consumers Association and other organizations for food movement organizing. But, you know, if one were, like what you reported, which is this kind of population is, you know, kind of acting up in New York City came as a surprise to me. Where would I look? I mean, where would people look to find out about organizations in their community that are working to stem this particular unhealthy trend?
Yeah, I think it's really tough because there isn't just a central clearinghouse like that as there is with some other things. I think it happens for a couple of reasons. One is that the really mass growth of organizations is actually pretty new. And then there's also a lot of tactical differences between organizations that might not find themselves in really that common of ally. So I think it ends up being tough about that. I think there's a few kind of signposts on what you would want to look for. Like there are militant anti-fascist groups, and there's lots of them. And those, you know, kind of commonly are associated with Antifa or anti-racist action. There's organizations in rural areas that have multiple chapters like Redneck Revolt, and then groups like the Montana Human Rights Network, which is across Montana, large organizations like the Southern Poverty Law Center, which does organizing nationwide on college campuses and things like that. So it really depends on where people are at, and I think it does require a little bit more legwork because there isn't just the central hub of this is what's here, this is what's happening. But I think the only thing is right, people need to confront the idea that politics isn't something that happens in the ballot box, it's something that happens in your community, and it's something that's the coordinated acting of people. And once we kind of abandon the notion that our prime political activity happens when we vote, you actually find people really engaged in their community and what happens in their community, and that's really what fundamentally changes it. Because what the alt-right and what far-right groups would love to happen is disassociate communities that don't have connections to each other, that don't have power together, and that they can come in and they can make those connections and they can build that power.
So where would be the sources, of course, you know, of information? So it also sounds like people need to, you know, in their own communities, maybe in some cases, somebody listening to this will, you know, be the one. Of course, obviously, they can read your book, Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It, by AK Press. Shane Burley, we're talking to today on Connect the Dots, and he's the author speaking to us. That's a guidepost to get you kind of fired up about the sad reality of this thing. You know, the thing is that, you know, there are a lot of memes out there that harken back to what happened in Germany. And you know, obviously this, you know, is in people's minds. They're worried and concerned about it. You know, they don't want to see this happen again. But then, you know, and I would be one of those people. But then again, there it is going on in one's own community, and one might not even, you know, be aware of it per se, because, you know, it's not being covered by mainstream news, you know, except upon very rare occasions. And so I guess what also comes out of this is that this is a local movement that's building up in different localities around the United States. And so to the degree that we are caught up with following national stories only, you know, so we speak of looking to the election cycle or looking to the Russiagate, you know, these are basically that we're kind of spoon-fed and sort of worked up about, you know, national events on so-called liberal media like MSNBC or CNN, you know, and they're kind of banging the drum for the latest, you know, tweet or whatever was said in Washington. And actually, that hasn't proven very effective either because the opposition has not been successful in, you know, stemming any of this. We just, you know, with a recent passage of the tax scam bill, which is going to further economically disadvantage people and thus feed fire on the very dynamics that we're discussing today, you know, we're kind of looking at that level impotently and then thinking there's nothing we can do. What you're saying is, yes, there is something you can do, and it needs to be done on the local level, in community by community. And of course, back in the good old days when, you know, we had a government, which that's really quite some time back, when we had a government where, oh, you know, we can pass a law on the national level and, you know, just take care of this and all will be well. You know, let's just do that. But, you know, unfortunately, it's kind of, you know, we're not having good luck on the national level. And that means, in effect, we do have to kind of take it to the local and community and regional level. So, you know, one question I'm just, this is kind of an aside, but I'm frequently asked, and we mentioned some of the outlets that you have contributed to, and, you know, people are always asking when I criticize mainstream media, well, what should I actually follow? I'd love to hear your suggestions of, you know, where people can kind of get a grip and get a sense of some of these issues.
Yeah, there's a lot of great publications out there, which is one of the concerns with issues like net neutrality of whether it's going to become a more difficult playing field for a lot of smaller left-leaning publications. So one of the, I think the publication that's been on top of the, covering the far right, covering white nationalism really effectively has been Political Research Associates, which does a little bit longer form articles. They spend more time on them. They're better researched than a lot of places. And they're understanding, the writers they have, they have a much deeper understanding of the issue and what it actually looks like. The large media outlets were very unsuccessful for quite a while in covering the alt-right. They found it very confusing. And that makes sense. It's confusing. It doesn't play by normal rules. It talks like the left sometimes. It comes from, you know, largely online communities that are then trying to move out to the real world rather than the other way around. So it was difficult to cover, but it was shockingly long time that they had difficulty covering it. They confused it with kind of Beltway Trump Republicans. They confused it with Heartland people. And so a lot of good publications that have been watching it for a while didn't do that. And so I think Political Research Associates is one of those. I think there's a lot of publications that hit things from – in different ways, you know. Labor Notes, for example, the way they cover organized labor has been really stellar in these times. The way they cover other social movements has been really good. And I think a lot of publications are carving out their own pathway. And then I think some areas of the large-scale media have done well as well. It's just it's been more difficult when it's coming to more specific social movement issues and more specific issues in general. It's we don't have the media infrastructure that we once had to cover local issues in that way. So, and I a lot of ways, when it comes to those local issues, I don't think we've actually found good alternatives. I don't think that alternative publications have the capacity to go after those in the way that the regional newspapers used to.
Yes, right. That's really true. I was just taking a long trip and was listening to an audio tape in the car, you know, a CD of Jane Mayer's book Dark Money about the Koch brothers and their persistent, strategic, long-term takeover, which we're now seeing in action. And, you know, it's fantastic that she was able to do the research and document all of this and really kind of nail down what happened and really show us what real planning with, you know, funding behind it can look like. And unfortunately, it's working against, you know, the survival of democracy and the survival of human beings on planet Earth, not to mention other species as well. But one of the things that's amazing is that, you know, Jane Mayer still walks and talks among us, you know, having covered these two power players. And the reason for it is that she has, you know, a journalistic outlet behind her that is serializing her work. You know, she's not an independent in the progressive media. And this is what journalism used to do, and it's much more rarely done. As these infrastructures that support democracy kind of get prayed or corrupted or taken over, you know, we are in a lesser position for fighting back unless we rebuild them. And I always tell people to support independent media for that reason. You know, tell us a little bit about, you know, your background and what led you to, you know, to write your book.
Yeah. Well, I've been working as a journalist for a number of years and writing specifically about those issues, and also have an organizing background as well. And so it was the confluence of those that got me focused on that. You know, if I go back a number of years, I was living in upstate New York. I was teaching at a college there, and there was a number of groups in the region that were bringing David Irving there. And David Irving, for people who don't know, is probably the most well-known Holocaust denier. He was a World War II historian that over time started to believe that there was no gas chambers at Auschwitz, and that the idea of the Holocaust was a ploy by German Jews in association with Israel. And so his appearance is kind of a really good example of the confluence of far-right forces that he attracts, you know, Klansmen, neo-Nazis, Keaton Tide kind of people. And so a lot of them were descending in upstate New York. And when we were trying to create the counter-organizing for it, it didn't speak to a lot of people. They didn't think this issue was that important. There was kind of a vague free speech argument thrown around, which is completely illegitimate. And so it became really difficult, and it became really obvious that the connection between these issues, the connection between these people, and the connection between their activities and acts of violence needs to be made for people, because that's the reality. And it's one that goes unseen largely in middle-class white community. And so that gave, in a lot of ways, the impetus. And when doing the research for that, I stumbled upon Richard Spencer and AlternativeRight.com, and this is many years ago, this is 2011. And so that was really where we saw something that had the possibility of growing and that could really, really explode. And so I started focusing on the alt-right before with a very well-known concept. And so when it really hit strong in 2015, there started to be a body of work about it. And that's really also the same time as the mainstream media was really failing to be able to live up to coverage on it, because it was confusing and it was coming from places that they weren't looking at. And so that's really what led me up to writing the book. And in a lot of ways, we didn't have very good guidebooks and histories and understandings of where these movements come from, how do they actually work, and what their goals are, and what happens when they're not confronted effectively. And that's something we really, really need to watch.
Yeah, that's really important. Can you talk about, you know, Holocaust denial? I mean, it sounds kind of so off the wall and crazy. Can you just kind of unpack what that is and you know, like, I mean, we had to see climate denial, and now you're describing this. Can you just talk about that for a few moments and kind of orient our listeners?
Yeah. One of the things that really destroys the narrative of fascist movements is the fascist own behavior. They really would love for the idea of white nationalism to come across much more palatably to people. Like, oh, this is kind of authoritarian nationalism. It actually helps people. People are very happy under it, that kind of thing. Except we have very obvious examples with lots of historical records and media evidence and things like that. And so what they would like to do is undermine that narrative as much as possible so that they can present their own counter narrative and that it doesn't kind of tarnish their image of politics and their goals. And so Holocaust denial really started in the days after the liberating of German camps. Nazis themselves would refuse to admit to it in many cases. And then Nazi allies around the world began denying the existence of the camps almost right away. And so what you had was people who would try and pick at the minutia of the evidence to try and poke holes in it, therefore to say this whole narrative was one that's incorrect and actually created by world Jewry to get, you know, kinds of reparations or something. And so for years and years, there was a certain culture of Holocaust denial amongst a kind of pseudo-academics. You know, these are the neo-Nazis that kind of like to act like academics. They try and, you know, have conferences that look like academic conferences. They write books that kind of, the tone of them are kind of academic in ways. And so what they would do was they would use an academic veneer, would say, hey, this is just a historical records conference. We're just, you know, talking about historical issues. You know, we're challenging orthodoxy or something. And then they would use that to try and argue that the Holocaust itself was a political conspiracy that was made up by Jews. And so that for a long time also gave them the opportunity to recruit from conspiracy theorist groups that were already trying to, you know, make up strange theories about whatever political issue was happening. And it gave them the academic veneers they wanted. So this was kind of a crossover. We called them like a crossover moment. It's where they're able to reach past their kind of choir and use a certain methodology to get access to a larger community. And so that went on for a number of years. The problem with Holocaust denial is that the proof of the Holocaust is so ever-present, and it's so obvious, and it's so available to most people, that it's really difficult for them to make most of these claims. There's a larger media infrastructure, it's really easy to refute them. And so over time, people had that evidence accessible and ready to them, and their various movements to confront the Holocaust began to be shut down pretty heavily. And so at this point, all the major Holocaust denial institutions, there was journals, a thing called the Institute for Historical Review. It sounds very professional, but that's what it was. It was a Holocaust denial think tank. And most of them are pretty now defunct. And as of 2015, that's where it kind of stood, was that Holocaust denial was kind of a dead phenomenon on the far right. It has now started to be reinvigorated. There's a new generation of people ready to deny the Holocaust, and so it's growing again. And what the alt-right would love to do in any situation is to throw doubt on facts so that they can create counterfacts. This happens with a lot of things. Holocaust denial isn't the first line of their defense, but there's a lot of them. One of them is bell curve-style race and IQ arguments. That's become very, very, very popular in the alt-right. And while these race and IQ arguments have absolutely no scientific basis, and they've been refuted by hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of studies, most people don't have those ready for them. They don't have them sitting next to them when someone brings this up. And so it's very easy for people to try and throw doubt on reality and instead create that counter-reality, because what their politics need, what fascist politics require, is fundamental untruths. The idea that Jews somehow control world politics, that's a fundamental untruth, but they need it to be true for their narrative to play through. They need narratives about IQ differences between races. They need that to be true. And so what they'll do is they'll pull every bit of fragmented evidence and try and construct some kind of proof that wouldn't be there normally, but we don't have access to the information, you know, right ready. And so I think both of those function in that way. And so that's one of the fears that happens when we don't have access to good information, we don't have good education around it, we don't have the ability to counter that.
Yeah, so it's a good model of those kinds of confusion. And then you also have, the president, for example, saying things like, you know, the neo-Nazis had to respond because of the fact that, the anti-fascist groups were, you know, being violent or whatever, you know, so you have the president kind of putting forth also these kind of myths. Which brings up another topic, you know, a minute that the whole meme about fake news sprang up, as somebody who's been in the media for a while, I naturally understood that it was a generated concept. It came up immediately upon the last year's, directly following the presidential election. It seemed pretty obvious that it was going to become a basis for people accepting and tolerating that the progressive media come under attack and leading them to distrust, you know, things that might be said in the progressive media and all of that. So that whole fake news, meme is part of that. But I think what we're talking about here with Holocaust denial and some of these other things is, you know, an atmosphere where for every tip there's a tat, you know, kind of thing. And it's like two versions of reality have sprung up. and then people have to sort through them. It becomes exhausting and self-defeating for, well, for some people, you know, for some people it does. Mm-hmm. It's like one of the things that I very often hear people saying is things like, well, we don't know. We can't know. And, you know, the sense that we can't know is, to me, a sign that, you know, clarity, truth, honest reporting, the ability to detect honest reporting is being defeated, you know, by all of these things. I mean, what is your view of that? What can we know and how do we best know rather than getting lost in, like, these kinds of arguments? Like, you know, one of the things you mentioned is that, you know, some people were saying that, you know, fascist and neo-Nazi events should be allowed to occur in the name of free speech, for example. Like, how do people sort that out if they're, you know, kind of, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if,
I mean, as someone who's a communicator, I'm sure you've, you know, thought about this. Yeah.
Yeah, this is tough because there's a couple things that happen. One is the debate over the facts of the matter. And that's really
mm-hmm.
tough because hyper-partisan publications, I mean, we're talking about ones on the right, but this happens other places, debate the very kind of fundamentals of what's true and what's not true. And that's a very difficult
mm-hmm.
place to be in. I do hesitate
mm-hmm.
sometimes, though, to say that that's the core of it, because if we look at something like these free speech rallies that were happening a while back, it takes very willful ignorance on the part of supporters to really buy into
mm-hmm.
that. And I don't necessarily buy that it is simply because of misreporting. I mean, that's definitely a part of it. And so when a large of these conservative white communities say things like, oh, well, we just don't know what to believe, that doesn't ring true, because in black communities that are being assaulted by the police and are being threatened by white supremacists, they have all the evidence there for you. Like, they're experiencing it all the time. It takes a very willfully ignorant community to refuse to hear what's actually happening, to refuse, for example, to hear what the speeches are being said at free speech rallies. That when you get there, it's
mm-hmm.
very quickly a white supremacist rally, like, very quickly. And I've been at multiple ones.
Mm-hmm.
Like, these are not hidden things.
Mm-hmm.
And so it requires a lot of voluntarily refusing to connect those dots. And so I think it's important to make the argument very clear about what's happening and to make evidence really accessible to people. And I think that's happening quite a bit on the left, and it's growing more so. And I think confronting institutions like Breitbart or Rebel Media, which are sort of like crossover institutions in favor of the far right, confronting them as illegitimate and treating them in the same way that we would treat far-right actors is important, because they are ones that are going to distort the narrative and confuse that. I think the other issue is
mm-hmm.
the larger issue of politics and corporate control in the U.S. confronting information flow and the ability of people to organize themselves. I think that's a larger issue that we need to come at from a lot of things, but I think that the way it plays out in this case is only one part of that. And so I think we should think
mm-hmm.
about it in the same way that we think about lots of anti-corporate movements, because this is not new. You know, they make fake news maybe the meme of today, but, you know, rich people are buying up media outlets and telling lies for centuries. And so I think it's important that we keep in mind that news and information is always filtered through that kind of corporate lens of wealth. I think
mm-hmm.
The free speech argument is a really important one to talk about, because it misses a lot of key points. Free speech itself is a concept. It's one about being free from state intervention. That's where the concept comes from. So the state, for example, can't come in and say that certain kinds of speech aren't allowed or you know, enact prior restraint on publications, something like that. That's totally disallowed. I can't imagine any anti-fascist supporting state intervention on that scale. That's fundamentally different than the community coming together and counteracting and refusing public space to far-right people who want to organize. Far-right public speeches are far-right organizing. They use it to recruit, and they use that recruiting to enact violence. And so when communities come together and refuse that space, that's not an attack on free speech. They're not acting in the name of the state, and they're not taking away fundamental rights. And so when
mm-hmm.
when people have that kind of narrative about free speech, it misses the reality of what free speech is. And it also misses the fact that
our speech has never been free. That's a really important concept to bring back, is that media ownership is not available to normal people. We do not have normal access to public speech. And so it's one that's really a falsehood. And so I think when we have that conversation, we talk about those issues openly, it shifts that narrative. And that's a narrative that, that people in a lot of mainstream news outlets simply don't have access to because it's not part of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that really makes a lot of sense. In other words, it is a spectrum. It's not like an abstract principle that Thomas Jefferson wrote about, and now, you know, we must stand by that come hell or high water.
But also, even if we want to keep it in that classic liberal sense, which is not one I necessarily agree with, but it doesn't meet that standard, and instead it is a meme. And that's when people say those things like they're attacking free speech, they're just repeating talking points that were said, and it's not particularly useful to anyone. And so I think instead trying to undermine that talking point and create that dialogue is much more important.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. Well, this has been a terrific conversation. We're coming now to the end of our show. We've been having this terrific conversation with Shane Bailey, a longtime organizer and activist who has a terrific new book that, you know, we've been discussing on today's show. And it's really, you know, it's really kind of an eye-opener to realize what is, you know, what is going on in community after community. So I recommend listeners that you go out online and look for Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It. It's published by the AK Press. If you type the book's title into your search engine, you will surely find it. You can also follow Shane Burley's work on Jacobin Alternate Truth Out in these times. He particularly mentioned Political Research Associates and Labor Notes as places to follow this particular issue, you know, that we've been discussing today, which is the far-right neo-Nazi movement in the United States. Thank you so much for being with us today on Connect the Dots, Shane, and thank you for your terrific communications work, writing, and organizing that you've been doing. Thank you again.
Thanks for having me on.
And thank you, listeners, for being with us on this edition of Connect the Dots. We'll be back again next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Happy New Year, everybody. You know, stand tall, keep marching forward in connection with all our tribe and relations. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Be well in the coming week.